Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. A lead scroll was found in an old cabin down on the Arizona border. It's known as the Dead Lee Scroll. Steve Mayfield will tell us more about this. Is it a forgery or is it real? Is it a confession by John D. Lee implicating Brigham Young in the massacre? We'll learn more about this in our next conversation. I also want to remind everybody that's listening to this on my podcast, you may want to check out the YouTube version of this, because I have some photo of Lee's Ferry's cabin and also the actual scroll. So it's pretty cool. You should definitely check it out. Now back to our conversation. I also want to remind everybody, please sign up for our newsletter. If you want to learn some behind the scenes things here at the podcast, maybe I'll even give you some of my thoughts on certain things. So please subscribe at gospeltangents.com/newsletter, and I'll try to send that out every week or so and give you some behind the scenes things. Now back to our conversation. Well, I wanted to lay that foundation on John D. Lee because one of the things you are an expert on is something that I had never heard of it until you had mentioned it to me, which was the Dead Lee Scroll.
Okay.
Okay, so tell us about the Dead Lee Scroll.
First of all, I want to do a disclaimer here. I don't consider myself an expert, Hoffman expert. It's been applied to me. I kind of tagged my wagon on to George Throckmorton, who you interviewed. Mm-hmm. He's been kind enough to include me in stuff. I've assisted him in some things. Well, one of the documents or artifacts that came up in 2002 was a lead plate they found down in Lee's Ferry, and it's been given the nickname of Dead Lee Scroll. Will Bagley gave it that name.
Okay.
It's a piece of lead, very thin, so it's not hard, it's a thing, that supposedly has an inscription written by John D. Lee showing that Brigham Young, suggesting Brigham Young and George A. Smith, was an apostle back at that time.
Mm-hmm. Who St. George is actually named after.
Yes. Mm-hmm. A cousin of Joseph Smith. Did authorize the Mount Meadows. Well, right during the Olympics, they find this artifact in Lee's Ferry. Now, this fort was run down. It was locked up. You couldn't just walk in and do it. And it was dirty and filthy. So this gentleman named Alan Malmquist, who was a school teacher in that area at the time, but also on his off time, was a park ranger for the National Park Service. He was the interpreter, which is a kind of the historian down there. He had a 3-year contract. Well, 2 years he'd get paid, 1 year he wouldn't, but he could do voluntary things like at Lee's Ferry or Lonely Dale, cleaning the place up and be covered by workman's comp. Well, he's in there cleaning up because they had dirt up to here and bat droppings and rat droppings. So he's in there cleaning, and all of a sudden he comes across this thing rolled up. He opens up and starts reading. John D. Lee, whoa, that has something to do with it. So he cleans it off, and they look at it, and they come up, hey, is this a confession? Is this some document that points out to it? Well, of course, boom, everybody loves it. Well, March of 2002, the archaeologist for the Park Service, she'd taken it to Phoenix and showed it to Bill Flynn, who worked with George Throckmorton on the Hoffman documents. Right. Bill Flynn's not LDS. Then she brings it up to Salt Lake to George Throckmorton, who was my boss at the time in the Salt Lake Police Crime Lab. And so he examined it, taking pictures of anything. And of course, the fun part of it, he knew very well I wanted to see it and be there, but he could, I can't let you see it. You got to sit. So I'm just anxiously going for it. And finally he said, you can come and see it. And he asked the lady, can he see it? Oh yeah, he could have been here all the time, you know. And George was just laughing at me because he didn't. But then the next year in 2003, George and I took a trip down to Lee's Ferry to do an examination of the scene, look at the scroll again, and do a kind of look at the overall environment of Lee's Ferry. And again, with Alan Malmquist there, the fort's locked up, but he has the keys. He's the man with the keys, so we could actually go in. And I took photos and everything. And the examination that he came back with, he and Bill Flynn did, says, this is a forgery. It's a bad forgery. The spelling's bad, the names are spelled wrong, even how he inscribed his name was printed, because it wasn't cursive, it was printed, isn't the same as
wouldn't it be hard to print or to do cursive on lead?
Yeah, it might be. But John E. Lee did a lot of printing. There is a rock formation down there in Arizona on House Rock, We call it House Rock. And it's up against House Rock. House Rock. We call it Singer's Rock because the pioneers going through there would graffiti up there. They would carve their names in this thing up there. You have to go off the main road. It's kind of hard to find. But again, it's nice to have a Park Service guy lead it. Well, John DeLee inscribed his name in it, and very distinct.
Oh, really?
Well, you compare that.
Is this down by Moab, kind of?
No, this is down in along the Arizona Strip, right. I think it's still in Arizona.
The Arizona Strip between Utah and Nevada?
Yeah. It's, okay. No, it's on the Utah side, but it's a couple hours drive from Page.
Okay.
But it's to the west. But you compare that with how he wrote his name on the scroll, yeah. It's completely different.
Okay.
George, what George does, he'll take various examples. Here's how John DeLee did on the rock formation. Here's how he did it in his diary. Here's how he did it in another letter. And then you got the fourth one is what's on the scroll. And you can tell three of them are the same. One's not the same. Now.
Okay. Well, so the signature clearly looks like a forgery on the scroll.
Yeah, on thing. And everything was bad about it. Some young man, I can't remember his name. Bunty, I think, he did an examination and said, well, it could be an actual lead plate from that time period, the 1850s or 1860s, whenever. I can't remember the date on it. But we found out that a lot of the major lead was manufactured out in Arkansas and Missouri along the borderline. So a lot of it. But he wasn't sure. It might have been a new – he left the door open saying it might have been recent manufacture to this lead thing. But we don't know. So it might have been a legitimate piece of lead.
So let me make sure I'm clear on that. So you're saying that back in 1870, let's say, approximate year, that the lead could have come from Arkansas.
Yeah.
Or it could be a modern
manufactured
piece.
But majority of the lead was manufactured in that area. So it would...
Even in modern times.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
so this isn't something that he would have... I mean, if John DeLee had made this, it's not like he just dug a bunch of lead out of the ground made a lead plate.
They would have had it. Now, there's a lot of stories about it. Number one, well, he didn't have enough paper to write something. He had plenty of things on his diaries and letters and things. In fact, somebody look at his diaries where he's writing down the sides and around it. You know, he's using the paper as much as he can. And he had enough paper to write diaries and journals and letters and things like that. The idea that has been presented by Will Bagley, well, this is a very popular thing to do, is write on a lead plate. But I can't find any other example other than this one.
This is the only example of
that I can think of, other than when you look on the internet, it says the gold plates of the Nephites, you know. But we wanted to see if somebody in the Western United States during that time period had actually done that, written on a piece of lead, piece of metal, that we can compare. Still can't find one.
So this is the only one that exists.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then
I will say this, just really quickly. I was in Sandra Tanner's bookstore,
mm-hmm.
and she has a facsimile of the golden plates that are made out of lead plates.
Yeah.
And the idea is you pick it up, it's pretty heavy. And she said gold is even heavier than lead.
Yes.
And there's no, so her thing is there's no way Joseph could have done this.
But could anyway, run, yeah.
So there are some, so if any of my readers know Sandra and want to see what a lead plate looks like, you can go to
it's right,
her
right,
bookstore.
Right there in the bookstore.
She has one right there.
So anyway, this just some major problems. Bill Flynn determined that the engraving was done with a four-sided nail, but they rarely existed in the American West. They had the two-sided flat nail, but it might have been used with a modern-day nail.
Okay, so the because whoever inscribed this used a four-sided nail, and in 1870-ish, John DeLee only had two-sided nails.
Yeah. Okay. Most likely, now, there was a four-sided nail invented in the 1870s in France, but not in America. So we're kind of dealing with some questionable.
Yeah.
And then the idea is that, well, this lead plate has been sitting up in the log roof of Lee's Ferry for all these years, and it just kind of fell down. We found it. Well, that's not the case, because at least twice in the previous 20 years before this was discovered in 2003, the Park Service took that roof down and revarnished it to save the wood. So it seems like it just barely got
there. So somebody would have found it.
Yeah. Now in 1999, this is a couple years before it was discovered, somebody did take from who we found out they did a archaeological, architectural study, a big multi-page thing that National Park Service did. And somebody took a picture looking in to where it was. And Alan Malkin says, well, there it is right there, 1999 photo. There's the blood plate, because that's where I found it and never was. So I've got a picture of that picture showing where it is. So at least by 1999, it was in the fort, but it didn't come out of the roof. So we're assuming somebody probably just tossed it in there.
Tossed it in there after 1999.
Or before 1999, it was tossed in there. And it had been sitting there because, again, nobody was in the fort and you had dirt piled up here. So it looked like an old beer can or pop can that was just sitting there until Al Malmquist went in.
So now, was it actually rolled up like
a scroll? Yeah, it was rolled up. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Rolled up. That's why he called it a scroll. Okay. And then they laid it out.
So it wasn't a flat plate like
the
golden plates, right?
When they brought it out, it was, yeah.
Oh, so somebody actually had to unroll it.
Yeah. Al Malmquist unrolled it, and he cleaned it off, and that's when he found it. It's right now being housed in the vault down at the National Park Service in Page, Arizona.
Hmm.
So, and like I said, we saw it up here. We saw it the two other times. I know that when they first had the press conference in 2002, they showed it to the press and everything. But it's a bad forgery, according to George Throckmorton. It's bad. Now, whether it has any connection with one Mark Hoffman, we don't know. Bill Flynn says it's Hoffman-esque. Mark did work with metals because he did some coins and some other items. It was controversial. It was a Mormon-related. But that's all we got. Now, back in 2002, 2003, I wrote Mark Hoffman when he was in the Point of the Mountain prison three different times. I point blank asked him, Mark, did you have anything to do with this? I never got an answer from him. He doesn't have to answer.
He doesn't respond
me.
To anybody, I've heard.
Yeah. Well, few people he has, but rarely.
Really?
He has answered some letters. Jack Ford, who was a reporter for the Deseret News during that time, later became the spokesman for the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to him one time. He says, back when he was there, and he said,
there at the prison? Or
at
there
the prison.
At the news?
Yeah. He was a spokesman. He'd get requests from the media three or four times a month. Can we interview Mark Hoffman? He'd go down and say, Mark, does this paper wants to talk to you. He says, no, I don't want to talk to him. He says, happens all the time, but I can't make him talk to anybody. It's
right.
up to him.
Right.
I've asked Ron Yankage, his attorney. He says, if I give you a letter that I've written before and he won't answer me, you give it to him? He says, I'll take it to him, but I can't make him answer you. And I think Ron doesn't even think he's his attorney other than, well, when Mark talks to me, I'll give him some advice. But, you know, I'm not going to make my millions off of being his attorney. So, so it's one of those things. It's a mystery. Is it a Hoffman? We don't know.
Well, to me, it seems unlikely that it would be because the bombings were in 85. And he went to jail in 87.
January of 87, yes.
And so the earliest that we can even think that this might have gotten in there was about 1999.
Well, the first time we know it's there because of this photo. It may have been there a long time. But
so we have a photo in 1999 that was a photo of just
the of the interior of Lee's Ferry, but it's Al Malmquist who found it, says that's it right there in that photo. So we know at least by 99 it was in the fort. It could have been there a lot longer.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but Bill...
So it could have been sitting there for 15 years.
Yeah, I might have just got there. I asked Shannon Flynn about it. He says, well, as far as he knows... Kirk Bench may have said the same thing. I can't remember either Shannon or Kirk that we don't know of Mark ever being down in that side of the state. You know, if we could prove that, you know, here's a receipt from the motel in Page during that time period, you know, wouldn't that be great? But we don't. So we don't know if he went down there. So, and here's the thing. It doesn't have to necessarily be Mark Hoffman that did it.
It could have been somebody else.
It could have been somebody else. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, Mark wasn't the first one to do forgeries. He wasn't the one who invented it. He perfected it in a long ways, but there are people, and it's been surmised, and I agree with this idea that there's somebody out there learning from Mark Hoffman's mistakes, and they're going to improve.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm talking with George. He, you know, he's authenticated Babe Ruth jerseys that have been fake. And
yeah. Oh, yeah, a lot of stuff. It just
so there's a lot of forgers out there.
Yeah. I just say that Mark improved. He studied up on it. He read about it and improved on that.
Mm-hmm.
His mistake was, but he got to a point where he got sloppy too. But people wanted so bad to believe what he had was real. They would overlook stuff. As Dean Jesse told George one time, why would anybody want to forge a document? Well, yeah. another movie quote. Why would Mark want to do forgeries? Why? A line from Smoking the Bandit, Burt Reynolds is talking to his friend, right, about why we're going from Atlanta, Georgia to Texas to bring some beer back. Why are we doing this? He says, oh, for the all-American life, for the money, for the glory, and for the fun, but mostly for the money. That's Mark Hoffman.
Oh, yeah.
You read his story. It was glory because for 5-6 years there, he was a hero. He was the greatest thing in the Mormon history community. He was getting the press nationwide, worldwide. He admits it was fun fooling people. I loved it. I loved fooling people. And the money was good. Except the fact that Mark had a problem. He didn't know how to finance himself well. He spent money he didn't have. That's why he was borrowing money and bouncing checks all the time. And that was his mistake. If Mark had stayed away from the controversial stuff and just said, well, here's an autograph by Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, if he kept doing it, he'd still be doing it today. Mm-hmm. But he got in the controversial stuff. And he tried to go for the
opus, money in that.
Yeah, opus, the greatest thing here, which was the Oath of the Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
And he got to a point, and I think, and George mentioned it, where he had the one guy from Idaho that slapped Mark. You know, I don't care. And he got nervous.
Can he you had tell us his name?
George never told me.
He wouldn't tell me either.
Because he made 3 Oath of the Freemans. The one that's back in New York,
right.
the one in Idaho, and there's one in Brazil.
Right.
And it's like, Mark got nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the thing, too, was the fact that he gave Steve Krishna some magician papyri, which was legitimate. But Steve was going to bring Kenneth Rendell from New York to look at it, and that's where Mark got it from. Now he's panicked because I'm going to be exposed. So he kills people. He kills Steve Christensen and get him out of the way. He plants a bomb at the Sheets home because there was that.
Yeah, he was trying to throw
people off on it. But then the next day, you know, so my friend's killed, blah, blah, blah. I'm supposed to meet with somebody the next day. The person doesn't show up. He takes the bomb back. It goes off in his car up there near where is now the conference center. And what burned him is the fact he thought he could fool people, but this time he says, oh, I got in the car, shut the door, and a bomb went off on me because I just found it there. And the IETF guy says, uh-uh. If that door was shut, you'd be dead. But the door was still open. It just blew you back out, saved your life. So right off the bat, they're saying, something's not right here. Then they find the bomb parts for the other two were the same ones in his one. Uh-huh, same bomb.
Well, and George told me there were bomb components in the trunk, which I didn't know that either. So
yeah, there was just... When the actual scientists and professionals start looking into it, you can't fool us. You can fool the media, you can fool historians, you can fool collectors, but uh-uh. Right. Well, he goes up to the hospital and he lawyers up on him because the nurse kind of, you know. So he's stuck there. But one day it was the bombs had something to do with the Christensen Sheets business dealings. Next day, boom. And at first, of course, law enforcement weren't buying into the documents, but the media was, what's Steve Christensen and Mark Hoffman? Well, it's the salamander letter.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're pushing that idea, you know, and what happens? And, of course, then Dean Jesse's one calls George. George was working for the Attorney General's office, Wilkinson, and says, well, you're the document guy because you've been trained to do forensic stuff. Can you come take an hour or so and teach me how to do this? No. It takes 3 years. I can't do it. But he gets interested. He starts looking at this stuff. So he gets permission from Wilkinson to go work for the county attorney's
office. Who's Wilkinson?
Ernest Wilkinson Jr.
Oh, Jr. Okay.
Junior. He was attorney general for the state for a while.
Oh, really? So the former BYU president's son?
Son was attorney general in the state back at that time.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Ernie Jr. said, okay. So George gets hired part, you know, with the county attorney, but before they became district attorney, working for Ted Cannon. And then after a few months, Ernie said, I want you back. Well, I got a lot of work here because I got all these documents. And says, well, I'll quit the AG's office. I'll come work there. So now he's hired on as an investigator to work with the documents. He brings in Bill Flynn because in forensic, you always try to have 2 sets of eyes on things. So he works on all these documents. Now, I don't know if George told you the problem they had with the church overseeing documents.
Yes, he did.
Okay. The fact is they had to do an end run to Elder Oaks to get permission. Did he tell you about our lunch we had with him, with Elder Oaks?
No, he didn't tell me about the lunch.
Back every couple months, I meet with George at our local Mexican restaurant. And we just talk about things. Hoffman comes up. Well, back in November, we met at this restaurant, and Kirk Bench came with us. So now you got me, my brother, Kirk, and then, oh, well, what we talk about, you know, not talking about the weather or the sports. We're talking about Hoffman. Well, George rehearsed this story about doing an end run, getting permission, or Elder Oaks pushing through so they could look at these documents that the church had acquired from Hoffman. Now, Kirk had never heard that story, so it's kind of, that's a different story. Well, after we talked about this and how great it was, I'm sitting there, and they had their back to it, but the driveway to this restaurant, this car pulls up, this lady's driving in, and this bald-headed guy steps out, turns around and says, "That's Elder Oaks right there." And so I kind of said, "Well, what do you know? You're talking about? Here's Elder Oaks." Well, they couldn't see him. They're saying, "Yeah, right, yeah, yeah." So, okay, wait till you see him come in the door. A few moments later, here comes Elder Oaks. And we all start laughing. So my brother says, "Hi, Elder Oaks." He comes over, and we introduce ourselves to him. And and George says, "Maybe you don't remember me. I'm George Throckmorton. I worked on the hospital." "Oh, I remember the name. I just didn't remember the face." So we had a nice little talk and kind of teased him. He says, "Well, you're going to sit with us?" "No, I have my wife. I got a better offer with my wife," because he was driving. So they go down and sit there. Well, it may only take 20 minutes to eat, but we spend 2 hours just talking. So he finally gets up and comes over. I guess maybe now clicked what was going on. So he's talking and talking to us, and high compliments to George, you know, about the work he did and how important part. His wife's over there pulling on his sweater like, "Gotta go, gotta go, gotta go." Then Kirk jumps up and says, "Well, if I bring some books to you to your office, will you autograph them?" He says, "Well, as long as the books I wrote." And he says, "Well, it's Carthage Conspiracy." And he says, "Well, we're not supposed to give autographs out, but I can do that for you." And so we had a very nice conversation, you know, and it was so funny. Just we're talking about him. So our ongoing joke now is every time we meet, "Did you call Elder Oaks to come have lunch with us?" You know, but it's one of those things that, you know, that once the science got involved and once he and Bill Flynn started looking at the documents, this stuff started coming out that the documents do have something to do with this homicide, you know. And then, of course, Ted Cannon had a sex scandal going on in the county attorney's office, so he has to resign. They bring in an old county attorney named David Yoakum to take over. And the first thing he says is, "Clear this case off the desk. It's going to cost too much. Plea bargain it." And that's what he and Bob Stott, the lead attorney, will plea bargain it. And of course, at the same time, he's saying, besides pre-bargain, I need to cut budget. So, George, you're out of here. You're a little man on the totem pole. So, George is out the door. Mm-hmm. You know, after all this work he's done for a year or so on this stuff.
Yeah.
So, it was kind of sad, but, you know, George has been thank goodness, because eventually he became my boss in the Salt Lake Crime Lab, which one of the highlights of my career was the 10 years I worked with
George
him.
George is great.
Yeah. So, that was just...
I still want to. I need to set up another interview because he was talking about the Howard Hughes will.
Yeah.
I was like, oh man.
Well, that and his involvement and stuff, but obviously that put his name out there. A lot of people now, George Throckmorton, I know the name, but what is it? You know, some people say, Throckmorton, wasn't he involved with Hoffman and his bombings? Well, not with the bombings.
In a roundabout way.
Yeah. But with having George as my boss for 10 years, he and I have done some presentations like at Sunstone and so forth.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Steve Mayfield. In our next conversation, we'll talk about him actually purchasing a real Mark Hoffman forgery. It's a pretty interesting conversation. Check it out.
In January of 2000, the former owner of Cosmic Airplane sold it to Ken Sanders, who used to work there, but now had his own bookstore there and sold like Ken Sanders books. Well, he had it on display, and I'm just sitting there just, oh, I would love it, but it was like $4,000 he wanted for it. Well, I had enough in a credit card, so I bought it from him.
Oh, my goodness.
In August of 2000. So for 4 years, I owned
a Hoffman. So you knew it was a forgery?
Yeah, it sold as that.
Okay.
I sold it. After I bought it, I take it back to the office and show George, and he showed some things on the document that only he and I know.
I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.